As you know, so far, the present administration's military budget is just a small, small 1% or 3% or something like that, less than Bush's proposal. And from my view, this great opening now for redirecting spending was, you know, what an option. Russia is no longer the enemy out there. Suddenly it doesn't happen. But listen to this. Here's General Colin Powell, chairman of the Chiefs of Staff, said, "The Soviet Empire has now been replaced as a threat by something quite different. An Iraq, a North Korea, other demons and dangers that come along of a regional nature. We have to be far,
be prepared.
We have to be far more flexible in our thinking," and so on. Did we think that once we got rid of so-called threat of the communist evil empire, that suddenly everything was going to be peace and rosy, and now we, it's my conviction, that a great deal of that threat was in our own minds. Mm-hmm. And in fact, all kinds of things are coming out now that make it very clear that all the strengths of the Soviet for many, many, many years was grossly exaggerated to justify this massive military program that we had in our country. And of course, if you get rid of them, you're going to find not only new terrible things like communism, but you're going to have demons, dangers. Oh, isn't that interesting? Mm-hmm. Words to describe those threats. Now, North Korea is really a threat to the United States, aren't they? I mean, they may come over and invade us any moment. I mean, or Iraq.
Somalia,
yes. Okay, well, let me go on. That's just one. Then I open the paper to the next page, and it says, "Bush aides hide the truth in the Iran-Contra reports." Two aides to Vice President George Bush in 1986 acts of concealment to protect the Reagan White House from being linked to a secret Contra aid network after one of its planes was shot down in 1986. Iran-Contra prosecutors concluded in their final report. And this goes on. It's amazing to me what is publicly declared about many of our military operations overseas. And it's known to many people, but denied by
administrations. And I'm not talking about Democrats or Republicans, I'm talking about administrations. The general public
just follows this, what we're fed, and even though there's all kinds of evidence, we continue to believe reports that are given to us, handed down to us, I believe, lied to us, in order to justify the militarism of our way of life in this country. And then 5 or 10 years later, you know, there's the kind of public acknowledgement of that. But of course, nobody gets excited now about what happened 10 years ago, except the efforts of the Contras literally squashed a movement in Nicaragua that I honestly believe had some real hope involved in it. I was down there. I'm convinced that that wasn't a communist government. It was a government that was trying to make a serious change in Nicaragua that was on behalf of the masses of people. This 90% of the population that was landless, that for a couple of centuries had no rights whatsoever against a very corrupt leadership. And we all know the who were the leaders of Nicaragua?
Somoza,
yeah. You know, they were as corrupt as they could be. But American interests almost always are keeping the status quo out there, because we benefit from the present arrangement. Our investments are safe, our trade is and it's to our advantage. And it's democracy, and it's not for freedom, but it's for advantage to certain wealth and corporations and people to put down changes that come from the people underneath.
Look at the other stuff in there.
Page one, page three.
One of the Bosnian Muslims dash hopes for peace. The censorship attempts growing over there.
Okay. Well, you can go right on. These have to do with the past. Yeah. This has to do with the censorship. Against a homosexual act. Then I look over here to George Will. Now, how many of you know George Will? He's not my favorite commentator. He is a very conservative commentator. But 60 sensibilities shape interventionist foreign policy. George Will. And he's talking about the Somali, our presence there. Rangers dropped down ropes from helicopters, hovering what the Rangers suspected was the warlord or his operatives. A White House spokesman said it was a routine search and seizure operation. George Will asked, since when did chasing warlords in the Horn of Africa become routine? You know, since when? Here we are on a... I lived in Africa for 3 years. You talk about Africa, you know, most people don't even know where you're at, you know, in America. It's over there on the other side of the world. And here we're over there. I do not believe we should act as the cop of the world. I think, and when you become sensitized, now, it isn't because I don't love my country, it's because I love my country that I want to say, wait a minute, we don't want to get hooked into that, this is not what we stand for. George Will and I would disagree on many, many things, but, you know, he's an honest person. Why don't you run that back yet? Would you do that real quick? Because I don't think
we're going to take him on. But isn't it true that leaders tend to want to keep the general people afraid? I mean, they've got to have an enemy to put before the people to keep them, to be able to do what they want to do. So the people will be sort of apathetic.
Well, the churches go along with this government policies, almost 99%.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I mean, the churches, they have the flags and they were patriotic and they stand for what the country stands for. I don't see the churches are fighting the government.
Way back
guilty. We're guilty.
long time ago, Eisenhower warned about the military industrial complex. And the military industrial complex has taken over this country. That's the way I feel, anyway. And they built up the military industry so much that our country is now suffering from a terrible national debt. If they build down the military, people will be out of jobs because they won't need to furnish equipment to the military. And so it's a very difficult problem. I think that's one of the reasons why the Clinton administration's budget is so little less, because they can't suddenly change it, unfortunately, because people who produce, industry who produces weapons can't retool that fast. They have to find something else that they can make. They've known it for years, but they just haven't done anything at all.
Well, I tell you, I think we should be less tolerant of the present administration when they say, well, we can't tool down, we can't make those rapid changes. I think we need to insist, yes, we could do far, far better. And it isn't just the tooling down, it's the tooling up for positive programming for the sakes of people, whether it's here in this country or elsewhere.
That's certainly true, but it's not only the administration that's at fault. You have to look at the Congress too, they don't want the base in their area shut down because it'll mean people will be out of jobs, and not just the military, but the people who support them.
I'm sure.
Well, read that paper that I just read about plans to even cut down on the military war. Most of that article is about job opportunities here in Washington State. That's what most of it's about. And the good news, Washington, is you're not going to lose too many jobs here in Washington. It's going to be other places. And then down in the middle of the story, one proposal, because we have to keep our ability to go everywhere to snuff out fires, and we have to be able to fight two major conflicts at all time, that article said. So one of the things is, if we can buy about 50 or 60 large commercial jets, these new things that are going to come out of Boeing, that take 450 troops or something like that, this will give them this flexibility to hurriedly put out fires everywhere around the world. And so Boeing may get 50 or 60 contracts. Good news, good news. And by the way, if this were in Southern California, the major part of that discussion would be about defense jobs in Southern California. And of course, it brought up base closings. We have, most of the, I'm convinced that most military expenditures in the last 10 years, maybe longer, have had nothing to do with defense. First of all, we should call it the offense apartment. I don't think there's any defense here in the United States. Are we, who are we? Are we really think somebody's going to come over here and take over? Or, no, it's an offense department that extends
not only for offensive purposes, but basically it's to control so that our
trade policies and our investments and all are safe and protected.
And in 10 years, that material becomes obsolete and has to be replaced. I mean, it's all wasted.
It's almost sometimes before they get it produced.
Right, yeah.
They've already got something on the line that's better than what they're reproducing. Well, we're getting ahead of where we're supposed to be today. Peace. Blessed are people who want peace, right? Is that what Jesus said?
Peacemakers.
Blessed are those who want peace.
Make.
That make peace. Blessed are peacemakers. I have never met anybody that doesn't want peace. I've never met anybody that doesn't want peace. Or we ought to have peace. Everybody agrees. But blessed are the peacemakers. Or as Peter says in 1 Peter, seek peace and pursue it. If you think you're going to get peace by just, you know, gently going after it, no, you're going to have to pursue it aggressively. And in our day and age, especially because there are so many forces, factors that can be presented to destroy peace efforts. Well, I'm going to give six basic dimensions of peace, just hopefully quickly here. Peace is a concept. What do you think of this concept? Peace is the absence of war. Peace is the absence of conflict. Would you buy that? I think that's what a lot of people think peace is. It's just the absence of... I heard a quote sometime back that said, well, today at least we have peace, don't we? At least we have peace today. I mean, we're not fighting a major war anyplace. See, that thinks of peace as the absence of warfare. But that's not the concept of peace. Peace is not the absence of something. Peace is the full life, fully lived out to its richest dimension. It's not the absence of conflict, but it's the full, vigorous pursuit of good life. Shalom in the Bible doesn't mean the absence of conflict. Shalom means the good life. There's food enough to eat. Families are together. The family table is a celebration. There's housing and people are not freezing from cold. And it's the fullness of life, celebrating life. That's what peace is. Shalom is not absence of conflict. It's the presence of a full life. And of course, the word salvation very closely to that. We sometimes so personalize that salvation is, well, as a child, I thought salvation meant when you die, you go to heaven. That's what I thought salvation was. I believe that beyond death, I have the fullness of God. I believe that. But salvation isn't just hereafter. It has to be here and now. A little story. Oh, you ever been to a funeral where they had an open casket? Mm-hmm. And people go along and say, isn't he peaceful? See, he's peaceful, no conflict. But he's dead! peace is a dynamic understanding. It's vitality. There's dancing. Peace is not the absence of life. It's the fullness of life. There was an art contest. They were going to give a prize for the best painting to illustrate peace. And one painter had painted a meadow scene, flowers in it. Everything was tranquil, nice, beautiful. They thought that was looking pretty good. Then there was another one. A lady was sitting under a shade tree, sitting back, relaxing. You just knew she was comfortable. Then there was another painting. It was a waterfall that came
just roaring over these rocks and crashing down. You get to sense the power of that waterfall. And right in the middle of it, there was a rock that jutted out through the water. And on the rock, there was a little bird sitting on the rock, chirping away, just cocky, confident, happy. And they awarded the prize to that picture. Here, it's peace in the midst of turmoil and all. But it's that they said, it's not, the world isn't always a lovely, beautiful place. But peace is to somehow, in the midst of it, have the confidence and the joy of living. Okay, peace is also a vision. It's not only a concept, it's a vision. Peace is of what could be. And it, in the Bible, we talk about peace. You know, one thing looks back. That was, you know, one picture is that was the idyllic time when people really, you know, there was the absence of conflict. It was good. Something was missing. Probably free choice and a bunch of things. And it's looking forward, the kingdom of God. The kingdom of God is when peace is realized. And of course, that vision of that future possibility is what tugs us in the present, always pulling us forward to fulfill that vision in the here and now. Peace is a concept, it's a vision, it's an experience. It's the experience justified by faith. We have peace with God, Romans 5:1. It's an experience, and for us Christians at least, wow, this is what peace comes in, that experience, relationship, faith, trusting in God. It's not just peace of mind. A story, again, there was a man walking along the mountain, and the trail went down the cliff. And the cliff was a very sharp cliff, and the path was very narrow. And at night came on, it got dark. And he was walking along, and suddenly he fell off the cliff, slipped down off the path, sliding down this mountain, and he thought he was gone. And suddenly he felt this root of a tree sticking out, and he grabbed the root, and he got it. Wow! He felt great relief, peace of mind. Except, after hanging on for a few minutes, he got... It was tough holding on, and he couldn't hold it anymore, and he felt himself slipping. Peace of mind, and he let go. He was doomed, and he fell 2 feet and hit solid ground, and his feet on solid ground. Wow, that's not peace of mind. That's the peace of God. You know, it's not tentative. It's a full experience that we're grounded somehow, not just in something we've achieved. It's an experience we've had grounded in God's purposes. Peace is a concept, peace is a vision, peace is an experience, peace is a gift. As Christians, we would say it's a gift we receive. Billy Graham uses the phrase, let go and let God. Let go and let God run your life. It's that gift. And peace is a promise. It's no matter how much peace you know, you've come to realize for yourself or in your society, it's not just a promise, but it's not just something that we have realized, but it's always not yet fully completed. There's always something more to be realized. It's a dynamic thing that has to be renewed over and over and again. And finally, peace is a challenge. Peace is something you have to work for. You know, you can say it's a gift. Sure, it's a promise, yes. But it's also a challenge that requires you to do something in the process. For the Christian, peace has three assumptions. Everything we do is done in the name of Christ, the man of peace. He is the man of peace. And if we're doing something, it's in that name, it's in that power of that example. And secondly, the assumption is that no matter what peace that we might know, peace is never achieved until everyone
shares the peace, that everyone knows it.
And it's for all. And finally, the third assumption for the Christian, and this may be the toughest one, peace is very difficult to come to. But peace is possible. And I think this is one thing that a Christian brings to peacemaking. The conviction, you know, it is possible. I've been a peace activist ever since the Second World War. I was in the Marine Corps. Went in when I was 17 to save the world for democracy and all that kind of stuff. And it was out of my experiences in that I decided, hey, so something's wrong, right? It was in that time I made the choice of being a pastor. I was out in the Pacific aboard a battleship expecting to be on the landing party in Japan when we invaded Japan. And one day in August, suddenly they came over the loud system that we had dropped a bomb on Hiroshima. They said it was an atomic bomb. Nobody knew what an atomic bomb was, except it must be a big one because they said they wiped out the city. It was interesting that on that day, everyone was, boy, it was a celebration. Wow, this is wonderful. And more than one person expressed the idea, why didn't we drop it on Tokyo? We could have wiped out 1 million people instead of 100,000 or whatever it was. We could have, you know. And the more I thought about this, I remember going up to the bow, clear to the bow of the ship, nobody was around, and I bawled for an hour. It was as though somehow war just subverts all your values. You forget human concerns. And you're ready to do anything to the enemy out there. The sacredness of life is forgotten. It was out of that experience that I said, hey, wait a minute, there's got to be a better way. If we're going to have peace in the world, it isn't going to be by making war, I concluded. Later I heard this phrase, the only way, there's no way to peace. Peace is the way. Take that saying and go. There's no way to it. Peace is the way. And it's only, and the moment you adopt any other tactic to establish peace, you've almost guaranteed that you'll not get it.
someone repeated it with Nagasaki.
Yeah, then we did it again. What was it, 2 days later? Incidentally, to this day, I run into people and say, well, at least it brought the war to an end. And I believe to that. That's not true. The Japanese were already suing us for peace. The whole process had begun. And there are, you know, once 20 years later or something, they start showing the records. They showed the record, the discussion between President Truman and who was chief of staff, was it Marshall? And the Secretary of State, anybody remember? Some of you are nearly as old as I am. Who was Secretary of State? It wasn't Dean Acheson.
That's the only name I can think of.
Yeah. Who?
I said that's the only name I could think of too. I don't remember.
Well, whoever, and the head of the Defense Department, there were five people. And they acknowledged they had these Japanese efforts towards some kind of negotiation for peace. But the records show that they needed to drop the bomb, but for a political reason. We need to show the Russians that we have this power. We're already, the Cold War, you know, they were our allies, by the way, at the time. But we needed to show them that we had this capacity and that they better listen to us or we were going to, you know. That was the primary reason for dropping that bomb. And I know an awful lot of people, especially people that were out in the Pacific like myself, thought that's the reason we got to come home so soon. But that wasn't it. I mean, we'd be coming home anyway. By the way, a couple of weeks later, I was aboard the USS Missouri, which was the battleship on which they signed the peace surrender. So 1945, we pulled into Tokyo Bay, and I was in the honor guard. I was about 15 feet from General MacArthur and Admiral Wainwright, and King and Nimitz, and had representatives from all the nations that were allies, Australia, Britain, France, China. They were allies. Russia, they were allies. They had Russia television people there. They were climbing all over us to get pictures because we were just about 15 feet from where they were signing this stuff. It was interesting. Our allies that day, by the time our ship got back to the Panama Canal, got into New York for Navy Day in 1945, this is a month and a half later, if you read the papers, it wasn't Germany and France that were the enemies. We just defeated them. Who was the big enemy? It was Russia. They were our allies in this thing. And just this flip. And it took me a long time. What gives here? It's as though somebody up there determines who's going to be our friend and who's going to be an enemy. And then if they're an enemy, they're wonderful. I mean, if they're friends, they're wonderful. If they're enemy, then they're demons. You know, then, of course, I grew up. Who were Japanese? Boy, they were slanted eyes, little guys. They went around, and all the Japanese movies at the time showed them as, why, they were like devils. They were. That's how I imagined them, because that's how they were pictured to us. And of course, at that point, China was our allies too. And of course, for a couple of years, they became the enemy, and Russia became the enemy, and then Japan became really our allies, and then Germany became our allies. Yeah, it's game.
Like little boys playing with their soldiers.
Okay.
In Iraq and Iran, we were against Iran, and then we had the Iraqi war.
Is that correct?
Yeah.
Iraq was the good guys holding off the Iranians, and then it flips over and says,
yeah, actually, we sold arms to both sides.
Oh, well, sure. You sell more to them, then you can sell more. Who is the world's greatest exporter of arms?
United States.
I'm afraid it's so.
What would you, may I make a comment? What should we have done when Pearl Harbor was attacked?
Good question. And I am ready to believe that that was the something, the end of an era. I guess the Second World War was it was a right war, I guess. But I believe that with the atomic bomb, and then the nuclear weapons, and they tell me they have all kinds of things greater than that. And then with the perpetual war mentality that has, you know, that war is simply obsolete. It may not have been in 1941. I'd like to ask our German friend over here, what would your thoughts on that be?
What is the question?
You're from Germany, and he's saying, what should we have done in 1940 and 41 and so on?
Japan, Hitler, both, yeah.
Should we have gotten into that war?
I think so, we should. On the other hand, some months ago, they commemorated the bombing of the city of Hamburg. It was totally wiped out in the city. It was in 43. And they thought they would crush the resistance of the Germans by bombing such a big city. But the opposite happened. The will to resist grew, and it needed two more years to really crash it down.
Yeah. Well, we talk about this emphasis upon the atomic bomb being such a terrible thing, but actually, first of all, in Tokyo, incendiary bombing, the kinds of bombs that drop just to burn the city. In terms of what happened, it was even worse than the atomic weapons. And then when we go talk about Germany, is Bremen?
Hamburg.
One night, we practically destroyed a city. Not a military target. It wasn't a military target. It was a civilian target. And, you know, we thought this would break the backs. Instead of that, you know, boy, that rallied the people, because, of course, we had pictures of Germans at that point. You don't look like a German. I thought Germans had horns. But, of course, I'm sure that if you're in Germany, English and French and Americans probably had horns. And that's what you have to do in war. You build up an image of the enemy out there.
Churchill was great on that, stirring up the opposition to the enemy with his great oratory.
Oh, his oratory, yeah. Well, I don't know, but I believe, I don't think, Iraq, there was no justification for that Gulf War. We should have continued sanctions. We should have continued all kinds of alternatives to that war in Iraq. And the war resolved nothing, did it? I mean, Iraq's as much there today as they were 3 years ago. And it's unleashed all kinds of problems. And of course, I think Grenada and Panama and Vietnam was a disaster. We never had a purpose. I want to talk about nonviolence a little bit, because I've had a struggle. I accepted the common idea that nonviolence it's not really practical, is it? That's what I grew up on. And I've come to the conviction that just the opposite is the case. Nonviolence is the only really practical, effective way of meeting the enemy, meeting conflict. I don't know if that was true 500 years ago or 100 years ago. I don't know. Jesus said it was true 2,000 years ago. And Gandhi said it was true 75 years ago. And Martin Luther King said it was true 20 years ago. I think it's true that increasingly, with the kinds of technology and weapons and the fact, the reality is we live in a single family in the world. We're not, the reality of the modern world, nonviolence, whether it's on national scales or on individual scale, is the most realistic, effective way of life. Jesus said, listen, if somebody hits you on the cheek, turn the other. And that always sounds so great. I used to think, but that's not practical. It may be the most practical way to meet. Somebody requires your coat, give them your cloak also. If you have one, somebody wants a shirt, if you have two shirts, give one to the other. Somebody wants you to go a mile, go 2 miles. By the way, my understanding is that under Rome, Caesar, that an occupying army could at any time require of the citizen of a conquered land, if they need your help in transporting things, I could require you to, here, for 1 mile you carry this, then I'll get another person, I'll carry it a mile. And Jesus said, listen, I'll do it. If they make you go 1 mile, say, gladly, and I'll take it a second mile too. That's the way to deal with those occupation forces. Rob them of their power. I think our image of the nonviolent person has got to change. When I used to think nonviolence, a person that practiced nonviolence was kind of, well, if it was a man, he must be kind of feminine, must be kind of easy, soft. He'll be willing to be abused and so on.
Sissy.
That's anything but the picture that we've got to. To be nonviolent requires it takes a strong person, woman or man, to stand up for the truth against evil or wrong, to insist on refusal to compromise. It takes courage, and it requires willing to pay a price, because you're liable to get clobbered. In fact, you're liable to get killed. Jesus did. To be nonviolent is not a sissy position. It's a position of strength to pursue it and aggressively, not just to resist evil, but to fully support and work for good, positive efforts. I want to talk just a little bit about this. Oh shoot, I thought I was in there and they had a chalkboard. Is there something to write on here?
Yeah.
Whiteboard,
isn't it?
If you can get that up, we're going to write on it. But because I think people retain things.
What about on the wall?
Is there any way to?
Jerry, what about that?
Oh yeah, use the wall over there. Who's a writer? Let Joan write. Here's some ink pen over here.
Please do not write on it.
Please do not write on it. Oh, I was going to say write on that thing that is not to write on.
Please do not write on it.
Listen, well, I just wanted to have you, I'm going to talk about four types of violence. Well, let me go on to something else. And she'll come up with that. No, I need to talk about this first.
I think she went to see if the blackboard was there.
Well, while we're waiting for the blackboard, Alan, I had a chance to visit Russia several years ago. The tourists, anyway, were taken to a city. There were 21 Christian churches. Now, those Christian churches were not destroyed, not as it happened to them. The doors were locked. All of them were communists. I don't know what's happened to them now, but when the communists were in rule, they still had respect for Christianity. They didn't go to church, but they closed the doors and did not destroy them.
That was not the picture we were often given. Well, let me tell you an instance. I was, in 1963, Drew and I were driving from Prague, Czechoslovakia, to Berlin. And this is 1967. We got to the border of East Germany, and we were allowed to drive across East Germany from the border of Czechoslovakia until we got to Berlin. But the permit was, we had to get through that day. Would that have been about 150 miles? Something like that.
Excuse me, wasn't that from across East Berlin to Warnemünde?
No, we did that too. But that's this is from Czechoslovakia.
You may not.
Oh, wait a minute. No, that's not what I... In 1963, I was in Berlin, that's what I want to tell you. And we went over to East Berlin. No, we were going from Czechoslovakia to Berlin, that's right. And we were going on the Autobahn, and my gas tank was down empty, and I thought, well, there was a town, a little village, I pulled over to it. And this happened to be a Sunday afternoon. There was no gas station, nothing open, nothing. And so then there was another little town on the map, we drove over to it, and there was still no gas. And by this time, I ran out of gas. Well, here I am, and, you know, I don't speak much German, and it's like 5 o'clock in the afternoon or something, and I'm not supposed to be there, it's not supposed to be there overnight. And I was out looking at my Volkswagen, and about that time, a man was walking down the street. He had an uniform on, army uniform. And his wife and his little boy. And I didn't know what I was going to do. And he came up to me, he said, well, and his very poor English and my very poor German, he asked what the problem. I said, no gasoline, no petrol. He said, come with me. And he had some petrol, and he lived over and he'd get it for me. And I wasn't sure what this was. But as we were walking along, he took out some cigarettes. And I don't smoke cigarettes, but he offered me a cigarette. And to be friendly, I said, sure, I'll take one. And I took the cigarette. It was an odd cigarette. Half of it was filtered. And there was just a little bit of tobacco in it.
The Russian Makhovka cup.
But it was Ruska something on this. And I took it. And suddenly it dawned on me. Now this is 1963. This guy's a Russian soldier, Russian army officer. He's one, you know, immediately I thought he would have shoot me or something. This is a commie, you know. And I'm sure
he asked if you were
at the same point, he asked me, English? No, America. German? No, Russian. It was a confrontation of East and West.
And, you know, I was wondering whether I should get on guard. There was this nice gentleman. He took, he and his wife were out for a stroll. They took me down to a house about two blocks away. He had some gasoline in a can. He drove over, put it in my car. And then he says, "You follow me, you follow me." I'm not sure why. Maybe he's got a respirator. Took me over to an Army depot where they had petrol cans under chain, and he had a key to these things. He filled my, or not filled it up, but like about 5 gallons of gas, is, you know, one of these big cans, and told me how to get to the back to the Autobahn. Nice, I tell you, that was one of those moments when everything changed for me. It's like...
And he wouldn't take a penny for it, would he?
Oh no, I tried to pay him, he wouldn't accept any money. And it dawned on me, we've made the enemy, you demonize the enemy. That's the way you deal with it. But when you meet them, it was 1963, I was in East Berlin, and I went to a national cemetery where there many of the Russian soldiers had been killed, were arrested, and they had these big, there were about 10 of them, great big stoneworks that had great moments that I think they were all great moments in the Russian conflict where there were Russian victories celebrated. But there were about 20, there were hundreds of Russian soldiers. They were on leave and they came in on army trucks and they were there as a day off. And I looked at them, it's interesting. They look like a bunch of American soldiers on leave. There's tall ones and short ones, fat ones and thin ones. They're Oriental from, you know, from Chinese areas. And they look like all the diversity of Americans, you know, black and white, and Irish, German, and there. I wanted to take a picture, so I had my wife, I got a bunch of us, I had my wife sit right in the middle of them, and I took a picture of them. And it was a Polaroid camera. And I thank you, and pretty soon I took the picture out, and, you know, in about 2 minutes I got a picture. All these soldiers, they look. Pretty soon they came over and looked over my shoulder at the picture, you know. I don't think they had ever seen a Polaroid camera. And they were excited. Wow! And then they said, "Hey, pick a picture for me, me, me." They wanted the pictures. And I had one picture left. And I took it and gave it to one of the soldiers and waited. Pretty soon it came out and boy, they were just all excited, and you know, it just, these could have been Americans, human beings. Once we get past these images, peace is possible. But we've got, you know, we've got to get beyond this meaning. I want to do something real quick. I want to talk about four different types of violence. Did we find
it? Tell me what you want
to do. Can you write up there? There's one kind of violence, which is personal, overt, and physical. Personal, overt. Try one line, because I want you. That's okay. Personal, just personal. That's okay. No. No, that's okay. Personal,
overt, physical. That's okay.
In my mind.
This is number one, so.
Okay. Personal, overt, physical assault on a person. That means it's some kind of an outward attack on another individual. That's violence. Give me an example. What would be an example?
Beating up
of another person.
King case, or the police have beaten up.
Bing case, king case. Or murder, or rape. This would be personal, overt. Now this is one. The second type would be institutional under personal.
institutional, and then overt and physical violence. But it's not no longer personal anymore, now it's institutional. Give me an example of institutional overt physical violence.
Prison,
yes. War would be an example. Where the society is doing the violence, in this case, socially approved, everybody's agreeing to it, but it's physical, outward attack on somebody. What we did to the Indians in the United States was institutional, overt physical violence. We literally, nearly wiped them out. Reduce their numbers. But it had society approval. It was institutionalized, not just personal, but it was institutional. Okay, there's a third kind of violence, personal, but covert. Assault. Covert is inward. There's no outward physical harm done, but it's an inward assault to dehumanize or to demean another person. The parent that says to their child, "What's wrong? You spill that stuff again. Don't you ever do anything right? Do you always make a mistake? Do you always fail?" You know, that's violence, because when you do that enough, pretty soon that child internalizes what they've heard and says, "You know, I always fail. I'm no good. I'm a failure." And that's as much violence to another as, hit slapping on the face. And maybe it's even worse.
Come dumb, stupid.
Yeah, you stupid kids, what's wrong with you, But it's done personally. And the fourth level is institutionalized, covert assault or violence. It's not personal anymore, but now it's an institutionalized thing. Give me an example.
Brainwashing.
Institutionally, they know what will happen. You control another person's mind, feeling process. Something else.
Discrimination.
When it's been institutionalized. Yes.
Military.
If you discriminate against women, we don't hire women, or we only let women have junior positions, not senior positions. That's an institutional, covert violence. Is it violent? Well, it's not. You're not killing anybody, but you're reducing their ability to have a fulfilled life.
International Monetary Fund.
International Monetary Fund, a little more sophisticated type, but yes, it's a way for the richer countries to control the poorer countries to the point where they're paying more interest than they are, costs them more to pay back the interest than it does to receive the gifts. Yeah, or racism is institutionalized. Covert violence. We're not out shooting people who are different race or color or something.
Don't allow them in a certain housing.
You can't live here. We don't hire you. This, that.
How about anti-gay legislation too?
Okay. You're gay? Institutionalized. And I was just down in Oregon. Boy, they're already facing. This is a...
September in two towns.
Okay, well, I want to, this is one way to look at violence. And I want to do one more thing. Guys, your time. Does everybody not talk as much as I do, or what? Maybe everybody has the same problems. Never enough time. I want to talk about the spiral of violence, because institutionalized violence is always progressive. It gets worse and worse, more and more. And Don Helder Camara is the one who first verbalized this. He's an archbishop, Catholic down in Brazil. But he talks about the three types of violence. One is the violence of injustice. That is, people face a situation where their humanity is not recognized, where it's suppressed, it's held down. And, you know, here in the Americas, the case of the North American Indian, the injustices that were inflicted on them in Central America, South America, the Indian population was just not only killed off, but they were put in a position where they could, you know, they couldn't have land, they couldn't have education, they were treated as a permanent, almost like inhuman persons. They weren't quite capable. That was the view. And that's injustice. And, well, we give a lot of examples of it. Now, in 1969, our government appointed a commission on the causes of violence and the prevention of violence in society. And their conclusion came up with that most social violence, the race riots in Los Angeles, where a group of people finally gets so fed up with a situation because they feel like nothing they can do is going to, no matter what they do, nothing's going to work. Boom! You revolt against it one way or another. And then this National Commission said that kind of violence is like lava coming down a volcano. It's lava coming out of a volcano can destroy houses, kill people. You can't hardly do anything about it. But that is just the stuff coming. What's the cause? Well, the cause is the fire deep down in the volcano that's putting pressure on this thing to erupt. And finally, when the pressure gets big enough, boom, the lava comes. And of course, you can cap it, can't you? Like a tea kettle. Tea kettle. Steam, get it hot enough that it's going to start steaming. But what if you put a cap on it? Well, it's going to stop whistling, won't it? But what happens if you keep heating the water over? If you heat it enough, it's going to be very destructive. Well, that kind, this, Camara says, there's injustice. And then there's the violence of revolt. The revolt that says, we're not going to put up with it anymore. And almost anything, even if it's destructive and non-purposeful, you do it because there's no other option. Now, most of us talk about revolt of this kind as a terrible thing. But let me read you something. Whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these ends of the right pursuit of happiness, it is the right of the people to alter or abolish it and to institute new governments. It is their right. It is their duty.